This podcast is sponsored by the Showtime documentary film, The Putin Interviews. Filmmaker Oliver Stone was granted unprecedented access to Putin, resulting in a series of candid conversations. Don't miss this four-night event streaming now. Go to Showtime.com and start your free trial.
The White House that President Trump has constructed has a lot of chiefs.
If she had become president, the world would still be this complicated.
This will probably get me in a lot of trouble. But I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry.
I've never seen anything like this. People just flat out lie.
Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week I'll be taking you backstage in a world disrupted. Join us every Monday morning for new episodes. Rate and subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast platform is. And do email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And now, this week's show. Hi, I'm Susan Glasser, and this is the Global Politico. We're calling this week's episode The Shove Heard Round the World. And yes, we're talking to the Prime Minister of Montenegro, Dusko Markovic, that surprised leader President Donald Trump shoved out of the way at the NATO summit in Brussels a few days back. We'll talk about the shove, of course. But just as interesting, I found, is the backstage story of why it mattered so much. A story about Montenegro, this tiny country in the Balkans joining NATO. But also a story about Russia and an attempted coup. And about the politics of Russia and NATO back here in Washington. I found this to be fascinating and revealing, and truthfully, I probably wouldn't have thought much more about it if it hadn't been for Trump and that priceless video of his shove. So I'm grateful to the Prime Minister for joining us, and also to Damon Wilson, who I asked to help us understand what it all means, this story of Balkans intrigue and Washington lobbying. Joining me this week is a very unusual combination of guests. It's our first time spotlighting both a prime minister from overseas and someone right here from behind the scenes in Washington. We're calling this episode the Shove Heard Round the World episode of the Global Politico. And I can't think of anyone better to help us understand what it all means than Damon Wilson here at the Atlantic Council, where he is the executive vice president. He's also a veteran of the National Security Council under President George W. Bush, and somebody who is what I would say is a real foreign policy entrepreneur here in Washington, which is actually why I want to talk to him. I sent him an email a week ago because I didn't know anyone else who knew the Prime Minister of Montenegro. And right, we all watched the video. We all saw Donald Trump at the NATO summit shove the Prime Minister of Montenegro. And, you know, in many ways, obviously it was an accident. None of us think he did it on purpose, but it couldn't have been a more symbolic choice. Is that right, Damon?
This is extraordinary. Susan, it's a real pleasure to be with you. And I have known the Prime Minister for many years. In fact, long before he became Prime Minister. This was the shove heard around the world. And in many respects, that's probably a good thing, because we've now had a reason to pay attention to what happened and why this actually mattered. This is a pretty big deal that we've just made a commitment to have another ally. This is a country that we're going to commit to defend and that they're going to commit to fight for us. And the reason this one is a big deal is because it happened at a time when we weren't really in the game. And we saw sort of a case study play out in Montenegro of what happens when America is ambivalent and how nefarious forces, in this case, the Russians, looked at how they could take advantage of that. And Montenegro began to represent something much more significant than a small nation nuzzled in the Balkans on whether this would join this alliance. The reason we ended up with a vote in the Senate of 97-2 is because folks began belatedly to realize that this was an expression of whether the United States, at a time of uncertainty here in Washington, would be able to lead our alliance and whether or not we would leave vacuums for the bad guys to fill. And that's what Montenegro became a story of.
Well, and not only that, but the fact that it would actually join and that the prime minister would show up at the very first international trip that Donald Trump took as president amidst, by the way, continuing uncertainty about the nature, at least of President Trump's commitment to NATO and to the mutual defense provision that's at the heart of that alliance. You know, the symbolism of this is just, it actually is incredible. Of all 28 other members of NATO, can you think of one who he could have shoved out of the way that would have had more symbolic resonance when we're trying to figure out what his intentions are toward Russia and towards NATO?
Exactly, because this is a country that the Russians had their eyes on. Russia has had a long historic relationship in the Balkans, and particularly with Serbia and Montenegro. There are about 15,000 Russians that live there. 80,000 have houses there. They'd like to vacation there because it's a Slavic Orthodox country in many respects, but the climate is a lot better, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. And yet, what's happened over the recent years is pretty profound. This country gained its independence from Serbia. And in doing so, the leadership took a very, very clear strategic decision. They didn't hedge. That's what we see in Serbia, hedging between East and West. This leadership said, we're not hedging. We're a small country. We have to take a decisive decision that our future is embedded in the West, that it's going to be aligned to the United States, and we want in NATO, and we want in the EU. And they said this unequivocally. And the Russians looked at this and said, not so fast. We're not keen on seeing more countries join the Western alliance. And this was a change. Vladimir Putin before used to say he didn't really care about what countries in the Western Balkans did. But they smelled an opportunity because we were ambivalent. The Europeans were somewhat ambivalent, and most importantly, the United States was ambivalent. We were headed towards the end of an Obama administration, the beginning of a Trump administration. This country was going through profound internal reforms, the strategic realignment. And we almost acted as observers to the process rather than owners of a process in preparing a country to become our ally. I think the Russians watched that. They saw that, and they thought they might have an opportunity. Just imagine if they could stop or disrupt the process of NATO enlargement with a small country that not a lot of Americans are paying to. The geostrategic ramifications would have been profound, that our alliance is faltering, that American leadership is in question, and that the great progress of countries transforming as they make reforms at home, they can be part of our community, that the Russians could put an end to that story by tripping up the small little country in the Balkans. They smelled an opening.
You know, Damon, I think that's a perfect introduction. So we're going to hear from the Prime Minister himself of Montenegro, Duško Marković, who I spoke with when he was here in Washington the other day. And then you and I will come back and we'll talk a little bit more about what the bigger picture implications are of this shove heard around the world. Well, once again, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Susan Glasser at the Global Politico, and we're delighted to have as our guest this week the Prime Minister of Montenegro, Duško Marković, who is, of course, the very first member to join NATO in the new Trump era, and he has come here to Washington, in fact, to officially join the papers. He did so on a very resonant day, the 70th anniversary of the Marshall Plan and the U.S. commitment to rebuilding post-war Europe. But of course, he's also joining NATO in a way at a time of a certain amount of uncertainty over what the U.S. commitment will be going forward. What is the nature of the Russian threat posed to countries in Eastern Europe who are NATO members? So there's much to discuss with the Prime Minister. I'm going to go ahead and get out of the way, first of all, the shove heard around the world. Mr. Prime Minister, you had a very unusual first encounter with President Trump. You know, do you want to tell us a little bit about it? You know, I know you said obviously it didn't prevent you from joining NATO, but did you ever hear an apology from President Trump? What was your experience with that? Just tell us what it was like.
There was no request for any apology, of course. What happened was something completely harmless. Namely, President Trump at a certain point tried to get closer to the Secretary General, and that's all that happened. Actually, that's precisely the way I perceive it. Namely, just before that event, before that contact took place, I had met President Trump personally. We shook hands, we talked a little bit. I thanked him for all the support of the United States on our path of integration into NATO. I thanked him for signing the protocol on accession. I also thanked him for the fact that his signing of the protocol expedited the ratification procedure in the Senate. And this incident, so to say, does not in any way coincide with what is happening in Montenegro. It has nothing to do with me personally as a prime minister. Namely, I was in a group of the leaders. I was in a group of prime ministers and namely heads of governments and states. And at the invitation of the Secretary General Stoltenberg, we were making a tour of the new headquarters of, namely, the new NATO building. And we went on a tour. We were in a place that is called Agora, which is a big hall inside of the building. And several leaders were behind us. Among them, there was President Trump. And they were some, let's say, 100 meters behind us. And at a certain point, President Trump wanted to catch up with the Secretary General to get closer to him, and that's when this contact happened. It was referred to by most media outlets as pushing or shoving, but it was after all only a harmless incident. And I have to say that I'm very grateful that this incident, so to say, took place, because this is what made us so famous. This is what made Montenegro so famous throughout the entire world.
I think that's right. I do think that if there was anything that could have immediately increased the prominence of Montenegro's joining of NATO, it was certainly that. And I also was told that, in a way, that might be responsible for why you got the White House meeting here yesterday and met with Vice President Pence. That was not planned before. Is that right?
No, absolutely not.
This has nothing to do with our plans and with the meeting that was held yesterday in the White House. Namely, we were just waiting for the right timing. We were waiting for Vice President Pence to have some free time so that we can come here and arrange this meeting. This meeting represents just a continuation of good bilateral relations between the United States and Montenegro. These relations are very good, and we established relations at the highest level. Let me just remind you that 4 weeks ago we had a meeting. I had a meeting with the Secretary of State, Mr. Tillerson, precisely here in Washington, D.C. And this meeting with Vice President Pence is just a continuation of the already good and established high-level relations. Our partnership in this new capacity of the new NATO member state and the United States represents, in a way, reinforcement of our already good relations, intensifying of our already good relations. So let me just repeat once again that the meeting with the Vice President Pence had nothing to do with the Brussels event.
So yesterday you officially joined NATO, and Russia issued a very kind of grim statement about it. It said that this was a hostile course. It blamed anti-Russia hysteria inside Montenegro for the decision, and spoke in a vague way of retaliatory measures that it might take as a result of this. What kind of retaliation do you expect from the Russians?
This is actually the path that we have chosen. This was our key priority in the policy, in our national policy. We have posed as our priorities integration into NATO and European Union. And this was not some sort of hidden policy of ours or some sort of hidden agenda. This is something of which we had already previously informed all of our friends, all of our allies, but also those who do not agree with our orientation and with our goals. Namely, in 2006, when we restored our independence and when we restored our state, we clearly defined our goals in our Declaration on Independence, which was passed in our parliament. So in this declaration, we stipulated some provisions stating that NATO and European Union would be the ultimate goals of our state policy. We were not hiding anything from anyone. And at that point, the Russian Federation did not pose any question about any of these matters. Namely, in a five-year period, we were having negotiations and talks. We were drafting action plans, membership action plans, which were issued annually. We were involved in dialogue with NATO, and Russia never had any problem with that. They never posed any question about this. So this moment is very specific in terms of geopolitical situation, the moment of accession of Montenegro to NATO, namely. This is the moment which coincides with the relations between NATO and Russia, also European Union and Russia, which are at the lowest point, namely this finalization stabilization of Montenegrin accession to NATO coincides with the lowest relations between EU and Russia following annexation of Crimea and following actually Russian attack on Ukraine. Also, this is the moment when relations between NATO and Russia are worse than ever. The same goes for relations between the United States and Russia. Now, these relations are less productive than ever. All of those coincidences actually had a lot of influence in us. We regret because of the Russian decision and because of their stance. Namely, we are not responsible for such actions. We didn't do anything to provoke such reactions from the Russian side. Russian politicians are responsible for that. This sort of behavior from Russia is not something that is democratic. This is not something that is in line with civilizational standards, with political standards. They are not supposed to hamper us on our part. We are supposed to be able to choose our own destiny. We spend so much time wandering through those wastelands because we have a very negative heritage from our past. Our country has been falling behind Europe a lot. Actually, we have to do everything it takes to make the quality of life of our citizens better. This is our natural right, and we have agreed, all of us have agreed on that. Russia has no solid arguments for its actions. Of course, Montenegro does not pose any sort of threat to Russia. Montenegro in NATO is not a threat to Russia. Montenegro in NATO can only be conducive to peace and stability, to expanding this area of welfare, of regional cooperation, and good neighborly relations. Russia has always been our traditional friend, but despite that, Russia did not understand this latest move that we made. We did not expect such sort of reactions, and Russia does not have any right to interfere with the will of our citizens and their choice of their own destiny. Montenegro is now in NATO, and that's a fact that cannot be disputed. By becoming a NATO member state, we secured our sovereignty and our independence, our right to manage our own destiny. Russia should understand that. They should accept that. And today, after yesterday's historic day, we have to send a message. The message that we want to send is that we want to be engaged in conversation, in dialogue, and not in confrontation. So we are not actually afraid, and we believe that Russian approach will change. They will accept this indisputable fact that Montenegro is a NATO member state, and they will agree to engage in dialogue and conversation with us.
You've described the joining of NATO as, in effect, a guarantee of independence for Montenegro. There's been a lot of debate and discussion here in the U.S. and in Europe about whether President Trump really still holds to the commitment that's implicit in NATO, which is the Article 5 commitment to defend small countries. Do you believe that if you were attacked by Russia or some other country, that the United States would come to your defense?
Yes, of course, indeed. We do not expect any attack whatsoever, especially we do not expect any attacks from Russia. But, of course, we should talk about presumptions and possibilities in the future. The United States hasn't changed its position in terms of NATO. The United States still believes in the goals and values of the alliance. Vice President Pence spoke last night. He addressed the audience at last night's gala thrown by the Atlantic Council, and he clearly stated that the United States remains committed to observance of Article 5 of Washington Treaty, namely that they stand ready in this one for all for one scheme, so to say. The United States will be consistently adhering to that article of the Washington Treaty. And Vice President Pence said also on behalf of President Trump that as those threats grow, as the number of adversaries is growing, the strength of NATO should also be growing, and solidarity should be reinforced within the 29 29 member states of the alliance. Namely, we believe that in the future, the alliance will be working towards maintenance of peace and stability, and not in any way towards provoking any conflicts, especially not armed conflicts.
So you were at the NATO summit last week, of course, in Brussels, and you met with the other 28 leaders who were there. At the private dinner, I'm told there was a real back and forth over President Trump's desire to increase the spending on the part of some of the other NATO members who have not spent up to 2% of their GDP. How would you characterize, you know, the different groups of leaders who you met with? You know, what is the debate, do you think, inside of NATO over these questions that President Trump has raised for them?
Of course, I believe firmly that all the NATO member states should participate in this equal burden sharing, namely equitable burden sharing, as we refer to it. It is one of the obligations stemming from a membership and from all the recommendations and suggestions that we've taken on. Namely, we have to have some adequate allocations from our GDPs for defense, namely Montenegro. Montenegro will pursue all of those recommendations from Wales, and we hope to reach that 2% GDP allocations for defense threshold. Currently, we are at 1.66% of our GDP, and we believe that we will reach this 2% threshold by 2024. So there is no dilemma on the side of Montenegro whatsoever. And the truth is that not all the countries have already reached this level, and the United States' insistence on reaching this 2% goal is completely justified. In that sense, we believe that we have to adhere to all of those recommendations that we accepted in Wales and that were once again reaffirmed in Brussels. It's not that we should only reach this 2% GDP allocations for defense. We also have to take care of the structure of those allocations. Namely, a part of these allocations should be geared towards improving our defense system and towards strengthening of our local, of our national capacities. So there is no dilemma whatsoever. Depending on all the upcoming security challenges and threats that we might expect, we have to work on managing the structure of those assets, of those allocations in the right way. So with regard to your question concerning the summit in Brussels and talks over the dinner, I have to say that this is something that I cannot comment on right now because this session was private. This dinner session was private. It was closed for the public. So in that sense, I cannot comment anything about that.
So I've seen some reporting that suggests that inside Montenegro, this remains still a controversial decision, right? You know, that Montenegrins are divided. Maybe as much as 40% of the public is not sure that this would be the right course. Do you think this is an irreversible decision that you've made? Could the politics change in a way that, I know you have elections maybe next year, that could change this decision to join NATO, number one? And number two, do you feel that what happened in Brussels with President Trump might actually give political cover to those inside your country who disagree with you and who are the opposition party? It seems like they have tried to use this incident in a way to criticize the decision to join NATO.
We were very transparent, and this dialogue was completely public. We presented both pros and cons in terms of NATO accession. And now I can tell you that this overwhelming majority of our population is in favor of NATO, namely two-thirds of the MPs who are currently in the parliament are in favor of NATO. Part of our members of parliament are boycotting the parliament in the aftermath of the elections of October 16th. As far as your question concerning the irreversibility of the decision is concerned, I have to say that this is a decision that is permanent. It cannot be brought into question, and it is completely irreversible. We did not make this decision on an ad hoc basis. We made this decision over 10 years ago, and we will stick to this decision. As far as the opposition is concerned, we hear a lot of noise coming from the opposition, but they have no arguments whatsoever. They have no solid facts that they could use to undermine our decision. It is their belief, actually, that this harmless event that took place in Brussels would slow down Montenegro and it would harm Montenegro as a NATO member state. But this is nonsensical. They have nothing to corroborate their stance. Over those last 2 days that we spent in Washington, D.C., Montenegro has gained tremendous prominence. And we really feel proud because of that. The opposition might not understand the interests of the state and citizens right now, but we believe that in time they will come to terms with the fact that they can do nothing about it and that they will start acting in the interest of the state and citizens and not in the interest of the third party. Of course, the next elections are expected to take place in 2018, and we do not believe that those elections will change anything in terms of our aspirations and goals and in terms of quality of life of our citizens.
I know you're about to head back to Montenegro, but you're here in Washington where, of course, we have been embroiled in a big discussion over the Russian intervention in our U.S. election, and our intelligence agencies have found that the Russians actively sought not only to intervene and to hack the email of our political parties, but actually to do so on behalf of one candidate, Donald Trump. In Western Europe, in France, there have been allegations of Russian intervention in the election. There are questions about what, if anything, they might do in the upcoming German election. Now, when it comes to Russian intervention and meddling in your country, the allegation that has come from your government is that, in fact, there was a coup attempt that was orchestrated by pro-Russian forces, including what has been described as a plot to assassinate the former prime minister, the current foreign minister at the time. What does your experience with Russian intervention, what do you think people here in Washington need to know about this, and how seriously do you think we should take the Russian hacking of our elections here in 2016? How big of a deal is it?
I was repeating this in every interview that I had ever since I took this office, ever since I took this office. Namely, Russian interference in Montenegro and their meddling into our political developments and into our political circumstances was actually reflected in preparation of a terrorist act. Currently, there is a prosecutorial and judicial process undergoing in Montenegro. We have solid facts, indisputable facts that cannot be brought into question, and we believe that the court process in the court, namely this judicial process, will give us the right answer to all of the questions that are being currently posed. We have no time to discuss these matters publicly, to discuss about those issues. Montenegro has other priorities and obligations that it has to deal with. Namely, now we are our country is a NATO member state. In 5 years' time, we believe that we will be also a European Union member state. And we have to actually make a shift. We have to gear our administration towards working on some financial issues and matters. We have to work on improving our macroeconomic stability. We have to work on increasing our economic parameters. We have to work on those new priorities that the government had set. As a prime minister, I will be supporting this fully. Russia will hopefully be ready at some point to take a look and see what the situation really is like, to come to terms with reality. And we believe that there will be no need for further explanations in this sense. Our aim is to provide for a better quality of life in Montenegro, and as a NATO member state, we believe that we will be able to do so. We believe that all of those threats that you mentioned, political threats, security threats, intelligence-related threats, are well-founded. Namely, I mean that all of those countries that are listing that are talking about these allegations, that are listing those cases of interference and meddling into their national systems, really have proper and solid arguments to substantiate their positions. So we believe that we should just rely on facts, and as far as the Montenegrin case is concerned, leave it to the judicial bodies, namely to prosecutors' service and to courts, to deliver their final decisions and verdicts.
Prime Minister, do Dusko Markovic, thank you again for joining us, and congratulations to Montenegro and to you for becoming, I believe, the first new NATO member in a decade. So thank you again for joining us here in Washington.
Hvala I vama, bilo mi je zadovoljstvo.
Very much. It's been a pleasure. And let me assure you that I believe that Montenegrin membership in NATO will strengthen political, economic, and social potential of the country, which will in turn contribute to spreading and expanding this circle of values enshrined in the North Atlantic, embedded in the North Atlantic Alliance. I also believe that all that we have done was done to the benefit of our own country, to the benefit of the region and beyond.
This podcast is sponsored by the Showtime documentary film, The Putin Interviews. Through a series of candid conversations, filmmaker Oliver Stone gives a fascinating and intimate look into the psyche of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Don't miss The Putin Interviews, an unprecedented four-night event now streaming on Showtime. Enter code POLITICO30 at checkout on showtime.com to receive a special, extended 30-day free trial. Offer expires June 30th. That's code POLITICO30 at checkout on showtime.com to receive an extended free trial.
So that was the Prime Minister of Montenegro, and I'm joined once again now by Damon Wilson of the Atlantic Council, former NSC advisor and really in some ways a key player behind the scenes in the story here in Washington of how this tiny country on the Adriatic came to be the first new NATO member in a decade, and to do so right in the middle of this massive transition of power here in Washington and this enormous amount of uncertainty, which I should say is still ongoing, about whether President Donald Trump plans to continue the same level of commitment to this NATO alliance, right? So, you know, here it was very interesting, right, in this interview to hear the Prime Minister talk about joining NATO as a guarantee of Montenegro's independence at a time when people are questioning, is NATO membership a guarantee of anything anymore? What do you think about that? Does it guarantee Montenegro's independence? And more broadly, people are really wondering about the future of NATO. What do you think, Damon?
So, look, from a Montenegrin perspective, this is a truly historic development. This is a small country nestled in the Western Balkans. It has had a pretty terrific record of not being sucked into the ethnic conflicts that have ravaged the region. It has a rich history back in the 1880s, but had always been part of the kingdom of the Slavs and Croats and Serbs, Slovenes, then part of Yugoslavia, then part of Serbia, Montenegro, but really dominated by Serbia. And so this is a country that just barely gained its independence and did so in a way that was nonviolent, that was not bloody, an exceptional development in the region. And with that historic perspective, its leadership knew that things happen. They have seen history up front and in a very difficult way in that region. And they had the foresight, the strategic foresight, to understand that even as we kick NATO around, ask questions about whether it's obsolete, that for a country like Montenegro, joining this alliance truly is a guarantee for its independence for perpetuity. This is one of the special things about our alliance that we don't always appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if Montenegro is in trouble that Donald Trump would expend one American life to save it?
I think that because Montenegro is in the alliance, it won't be in trouble. And that's the beauty of this recipe. You leave vacuums, you leave uncertainty, you invite trouble. Once there's clarity and it's part of the camp, I think we're going to see a sort of a blanket of security stability where we won't be forced to face this issue in Montenegro itself. We might elsewhere.
Right. Like the Baltics, for example.
Potentially. Mm-hmm. This is the important thing right now, and you referred to this. The shove heard around the world was taking place on the platform of all those questions of whether Donald Trump and his first meeting with NATO leaders would really evolve from the campaign trail of calling NATO obsolete. And as we had heard him increasingly say positive things with the Secretary General standing by his side, to come to Brussels and affirm the commitment that attack against one is attack against all. And unfortunately, he didn't quite say that in Brussels, leaving a big gap. And this is what's really important, because it is that clarity around that provision. It's called Article 5, that one ally is an attack against all. That actually means that is the preventive clause. That means we're not going to get into a conflict, because people understand you pick a little fight and you got a fight with the United States on your hands, and people aren't up for that usually.
Well, you know, so let me ask you this. People, there's been a big, you know, to-do, you know, here in Washington over how that sentence came to be deleted from President Trump's speech. And, you know, I wrote stories quoting sources, you know, including quoting the line itself that President Trump was supposed to give and didn't. Not a complicated line, just a short sentence, right? 27 words that he didn't say. Vice President Pence came here to the Atlantic Council the other day and actually said almost exactly the same words. But you worked at the NSC. Can you ever imagine in the Bush NSC that the president would give a speech that you were surprised that he didn't offer a commitment on a core principle like that?
Look, this was pretty dramatic, pretty exceptional. I think you've done some excellent reporting on this. Especially, I think that everybody in the White House knew that this is what the world was looking to hear. And on the one hand, I think the president has used his rhetoric for actual leverage for some good. We are seeing some movement in Europe.
Right, in terms of putting more money into
in
the
in terms of defense investments, mm-hmm. Right. Now, it's not clear that it's all just because they hear Donald Trump. It's also because they're starting to come to their own conclusions that, perhaps the United States isn't as reliable as we thought. Whatever the reason, that's actually good for U.S. interests that we're seeing movement on defense investment in Europe. The problem is that who also listens to the messages? It's our adversaries. And our adversaries need to know that our commitment is unequivocal. Because the way this alliance works is that it deters. And deterrence is about what is the mindset of your adversary. So the President of the United States isn't just speaking to the allies in front of him. More importantly, he's speaking to those who want to think about how to trip us up and to look for openings and cleavages. That's the story of Montenegro. The Russians looked at Montenegro and they could hear Washington's debate. They knew that the Obama administration wasn't enthusiastically head over heels.
Right. So you were following this. There was a real debate. I admit, you know, it wasn't high on my radar last year during the 2016 election, but you were following this during 2016. They had reservations about Montenegro inside the Obama administration.
I think that's very fair to say. And I think that was pretty well known. And I think the problem is that it was actually well known by the Russians themselves. In fact, there was a slight spectacular hiccup at one of the NATO meetings when everyone thought we would be taking this next step on Montenegro. And in many respects, it was Lucy and the football, and the United States kind of flubbed this, much to the chagrin of the Secretary General at the time.
When was that?
This was, I think, at a ministerial meeting in December about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And so, look, you're sitting in Moscow, you're watching this, and you're seeing, you know, there's not unanimity here. Remember what happened after the Bucharest summit when the alliance failed to agree on what to do with Georgia and Ukraine?
That's right.
We ended up with a Russian war in Georgia.
Right. They invaded Georgia.
They
and
did.
In fact, many people to this day look at that Georgia invasion, A, as a precursor to what happened with Ukraine and where we are now, but B, specifically the mixed messages that they perceived came from different officials in the Bush administration at the time might have contributed in some way to Saakashvili's actions in Georgia, things like that. So you felt there were mixed messages here.
I would push back on the mixed messages there and say the mixed messages to the Russians were because the Americans and Germans disagreed.
Uh-huh. Okay.
What I think we saw here was just a degree of ambivalence. Normally, I've been through a lot of these NATO enlargement processes, and they're pretty terrific. I mean, you've got partners who basically say, we want to be your ally.
Right.
We want to join the club.
Yeah.
And you know what? We know that takes a lot of painful decisions and painful work. Reforms, I mean, it's pretty brutal. We get involved and we say, look, if you're going to come in, your intel systems, your defense systems, all these things, frankly, we, you know, behind closed doors, we can say we think you have some vulnerabilities here. But when you're preparing an ally for this, you actually get into their knickers and you say, if you want to be in our club, you got some gaps here. This person, that gap, you got to address this. And no ifs, ands, or buts. We did that all through the process of NATO enlargement. Painful political decisions because these allies had to take it seriously, get in the club. We had a little bit of a posture of sort of observing rather than owning this process.
Mm-hmm.
And so this trip, this hiccup, if you will, I think it made the Russians look at this and think, this is potentially – the alliance is not moving forward in an enthusiastic way to get this job done. And what did we see? We saw last October a spectacular development that in the height of our own election here, at the height of our own domestic political distraction, Russian intelligence officers, GRU agents, fomented a coup attempt that was premised on assassinating Milo Djukanovic, really the leader of this country, the true leader of this country, the one who sort of began the strategic reorientation towards the West, to take over the parliament on the eve of elections, foment some civilian casualties, casualties at parliament, and to be able to then to use a political force pumped full of Russian money, frankly, that could actually use that as an opportunity to take over and disrupt the process of a NATO enlargement.
Yeah. It would have been spectacular. It's out of a spy novel, I mean, right? And of course, we weren't paying attention.
We weren't paying attention. It's almost, you know, if you try to explain this to people, folks think this is more, this is crazier than a spy novel, that it's hard to believe this unfolded right below our eyes. And nothing, very little was said out of Washington, out of key capitals when this happened.
Well, that's right. Not only were we distracted by the election, but of course, the Russian issue that was on our radar, even at the time, the Obama administration was clearly debating in very heated fashion what to do about the Russian hacking of the U.S. election. Obviously, we didn't know about it, but they were already investigating Donald Trump and his campaign for alleged collusion with the Russians. So Russia intervening in another country, you know, was just not going to be on our radar. So tell me just quickly, what was the Washington campaign like then? I mean, basically, it was a pickup basketball team of you and some other people, you know, trying to get Capitol Hill, in effect, to be involved, which is very unusual that they should take the lead on any foreign policy issue.
Well, let me be fair. I mean, we had some just terrific American diplomats involved in this process, including on the ground.
People
in the country,
on the ground there.
But here in Washington as well, and frankly, the Germans, the chancellors, the chancellor of Germany, her team took deep interest in this. So I don't want to pretend that there wasn't real work being done, but we didn't. This was a small issue that was had the fear of being sort of pushed to the side, not really a priority.
Right.
And that's not kind of how NATO enlargement gets done, particularly when you're changing a treaty and you have to get it through the Senate. So there was a team of people who, on the outside, began years ago, actually, in the mountains of Montenegro and deep snowfalls, sitting with the entire leadership of that country, to kind of read them the Riot Act and say, hey, guys and
serious.
Gals, if you're serious, you got to be serious. You can't just want it. You got to do some stuff. And so we really spent some time with the decision makers in the country, with civil society in the country, with political opposition that was really split on this, to talk them through, what are you doing? How are you thinking? What are you doing at home? What are you doing diplomatically? And are you really committed? Do you understand what this takes? Because it takes quite a bit. And you got to bring your people along in this process. But back here in Washington, in many respects, this team of veterans who've been through NATO enlargement, Democrats and Republicans on both sides of the aisle, stayed involved, cajoling and talking to our counterparts in the U.S. government, staying in touch with the interested members of Congress, helping to add to pressure on the Montenegrins when it looked like they were falling behind on some of the things they needed to do to get ready to keep this conversation going. But at the end of the day, this really came down to sit down and sit before the Senate, became a burden on would the Senate act. And I think this is where some tough issues came into play. We saw Senator Lee of Utah, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, basically throw up a red flag and say, not so fast. We don't really want to do this in a procedural motion that happens in the middle of the night because we're not sure we want to do this. And it really stalled the issue at a time when there wasn't heavy lifting coming from the administration. We're going through a transition.
This is literally at the beginning. It's in the first month of the Trump administration.
Well,
right?
It was coming at the end of the Obama administration and the clock ran out.
Yeah.
Then it was coming at the beginning of the Trump administration when no one had a clue about how this administration, how the president felt about it.
And of course, there's still no senior officials appointed, like an assistant secretary for Europe who you could imagine would have taken a leading role in this in the past. Anyone like that, there's no one in power. So you had these senators who were objecting, and basically it was Mitch McConnell, right, in the end, who said, okay, well, we need to get this done. And in part, I think the Russia issue helped you convince the Senate this was a fault line between Russia and the West.
I'll tell you, Senator McConnell had a lot to do with this because, look, from his perspective, think about how much he has on his plate at the beginning of a new administration, a new Congress, you know, huge, huge domestic political priorities. In fact, the week that he moved it was the week that the Gorsuch was moving through, the Supreme Court nominee was moving through the Senate for a vote on the Supreme Court, huge issue. It was the week that health care was about to go up in flames, but they didn't know it quite at the moment. I mean, these are big, big issues that suck up the calendar, the time. But I think the senator looked at it and was very receptive to the fact that this wasn't just a vote on a small country in the Balkans. Because it was stalled, because almost every NATO ally had acted by then, mm-hmm. and because the Russians smelled a little bit of blood in the water, Senator McConnell, I think, recognized that this actually was becoming a Senate vote on American leadership of its alliance and on whether we would push back and not leave a vacuum. And he pushed this into the calendar, knowing that it would take valuable time away from huge Trump administration priorities. And he delivered a vote of 97-2. Pretty remarkable.
Well, by the way, I'm glad you brought it back full circle, because that does take us right back to Donald Trump, the shove heard around the world, and this question of what is actually American policy toward NATO. Because we know that Senator McConnell, has a view of it. We know that Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, Rex Tillerson, and H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, have a view of NATO being indispensable. Mattis, the defense secretary, was, in fact, a top general at NATO in one of his command positions, right? So these people have this in their DNA as part of the American security architecture. But we now have a president who clearly were left out of that summit where Montenegro joined, still having the question of what our actual leader thinks about this and whether that in and of itself has emboldened Russia and may begin to unravel the alliance in some way. What do you think at this point about the president's own commitment to NATO, and how much does it matter that he seems uncertain?
Look, I think we're going to work through this, because it is pretty clear to me this alliance only works with the clarity of support from the United States. The United States has to lead it, and the U.S. president's at the helm of that. And we're going to get there. This is a national security team, as you said, that has this in their DNA, very clear about this. In fact, we know from internal deliberations, even before the Munich Security Conference, sort of in February, when national security officials typically go represent the U.S. abroad, that there were some pretty high-level deliberations at the White House where the president came around pretty clear of his support for the alliance, but remaining focused like a laser on real pressure to get increases in defense spending and defense investment, something that is in the mainstream of American foreign policy. He's just used a little bit sharper language and approach to do it. Look, it is important, as I said, because of how our adversaries listen and look for openings and nuances, that the president himself say this. He missed the opportunity to give a full-throated defense of our alliance and its sacrosanct commitment to defend each other in Brussels. But it's worth pointing out, as you alluded to, that the Atlantic Council did host Vice President Pence the same day we hosted the Prime Minister of Montenegro to celebrate their joining the alliance on the 70th anniversary of the Marshall Plan. And the Vice President used that opportunity to underscore the relevancy of the Marshall Plan strategy today, the importance of welcoming Montenegro as a new member, and that the door remains open. And he gave a full throttled defense of our alliance and of American commitment.
Right, but that's the problem in a way, not the answer, because now you have Pence joining merely Mattis, McMaster, and Tillerson, who all in various forums for the last 6 months have been giving full-throated reaffirmations of America's commitment to this alliance. The question remains, not only has Donald Trump not backed off, as far as I know, he didn't apologize to the prime minister for the shove, or more importantly, to either the prime minister or any of the allies for calling into question this alliance. I'm sure you've heard, as I have, much feedback from European colleagues who are genuinely worried now.
So, let me point out two things that are coming up on the radar screen. So, first of all, I spent a lot of time up on Capitol Hill. I have never in my career felt as strong of a bipartisan consensus in support of our alliance and in terms of also standing up to Russian aggression. It's a pretty remarkable consensus. In some respects, it's a reaction to both the real world, what the Russians have been doing both in our country and globally, but it's also a little bit of a political reaction because Donald Trump raised some tough questions. We've seen a rallying. We really do have. This vote was 97-2. I think it is. That's not a 97-2 for people who love Montenegro. It's a 97-2 for standing up to Russia and standing up for our allies. Second, keep your eye on the space. I'm pretty confident we're going to hear some of these words even more clearly from the President of the United States. There are reports out, I think, as you know, he's going to the G20 summit. This will be his next big visit. It's going to be tough.
By the way, it's also when he's going to meet Vladimir Putin for the first time.
But what's he going to do before he meets Vladimir Putin? There are reports out today, and I think this is going to play out in the next few days. Mm-hmm. The president's likely to visit Poland en route to G20. And not only visit Poland, visit Warsaw, where we have American troops stationed in Poland for the first time as part of our enhanced deployment to deter Russian brinksmanship in the East. And I think having a president surrounded by an audience of Poles, an incredibly pro-American audience, who will be there with presumably other leaders from Central and Eastern Europe who are gathering. The Atlantic Council has been working with the Central European leaders on a big initiative. And it looks like the president will be part of this conversation against the backdrop of a Polish audience, against the backdrop of American forces and country, and against the backdrop of all of our allies on the eastern flank who are most dependent on the solidity of our guarantee. If this isn't the golden opportunity for the president to be clear, I can't think of another one. So let's stay tuned to that space and hope that when you do your next podcast after July 7th that these answers will be fully addressed.
Well, you know, that's a perfect note, I think, for us to end on. I mean, really, it's a elegant and very Washington way that, you know, out of crisis, opportunity, right? And in many ways, whether it's the response to Trump's questioning that has caused people here inside the U.S. to politically reaffirm, you know, their views about NATO, or looking at the European response, I mean, I think we have a very good argument that, you know, it's not just a story about an obscure little country in the Balkans, but something that actually has real consequence, which is why it's been great for me to talk with Damon Wilson from the Atlantic Council and, of course, Prime Minister Dusko Markovic of Montenegro for this episode of the Global Politico.
Susan, I'll just close by saying I think the words matter. A president's words matter. And this is what our president is sometimes cavalierly saying things on Twitter, for example. Words really matter. And we've seen the consequences of an American president projecting ambiguity can be a coup in a small country in the Balkans. Words matter. And this is why I think as the White House and as the president himself comes to appreciate the responsibility and the authority of the office that he holds, I think he's going to come around to do the right thing and speak unequivocally about our commitment to our allies as well as their commitment to us.
Well, we'll see. You and I can reconvene. This is also a president who never loves to say he's sorry, so we'll see. thank you guys so much. Thank you again to Damon Wilson, and of course, thank you to the Prime Minister and to all of you for listening to the Global Politico. We're delighted that you joined us this week. We hope that you listen to us, subscribe to us on iTunes or on whatever your favorite podcast platform is, and of course, you can always email me with feedback at sglasser@politico.com. Thanks again for listening to the Global Politico.